This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Because it's all anybody's talking about right now, we'll keep talking about it too. Mackenzie Schirillo was 17 when she drove a Toyota Camry into a brick building in Strongville, Ohio, at close to 100 miles an hour, killing her boyfriend Dominic Russo and their friend Davion Flanagan. The prosecution painted a controlling, image-obsessed young woman. The threatening text, the TikTok persona, the volatility. Judge called her hell on wheels. But the loudest, most controlling behavior often comes from the most fragile of places. There's a lot of opinions out there online right now about Mackenzie Schirillo, about her family, about the judge, about everything involved in this case. And a lot of it making a lot of sense, a lot of it grounded in reality, some of it not really understanding human behavior and who people are and who they continue to be, and how sometimes a triggering event or a big event just doesn't really change a whole lot about somebody. Joining us to discuss and help us break down the Mackenzie Schirillo, the crash story, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. As always, thank you for being here and welcome. It's just you and me today. Robin is out. I've been really looking forward to diving into this because there's so many opinions that are out there on Mackenzie Schirillo. Before I start getting into kind of questions and thoughts and diving into different areas of this, the first area I want to get into is really the psychology of herself before we get into the relational ties that she has to everyone. What was your thoughts? You watched the documentary twice, just like I did. You watched it one time. You watched it a second time. What was your thoughts the first time you watched it? And the second time, maybe it was the same. You tell me.
Yeah, it was the same. I just wanted to go back the second. First, I kind of get my emotional gut reaction.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to go back and take specific notes about the clinical things. This would have been a wonderful documentary if I were still training new therapists and training interns, which I used to do. Mm-hmm. I would assign this as homework.
Yeah.
Because it's a very rich story, meaning there's so much information there that I think is really important and relevant. But yeah, my just initial take, which I still believe, we've got an emotionally dysregulated teenager with cluster B traits who acted impulsively in a moment of rage. I mean, basically a tantrum, mm-hmm. which goes with the kind of traits that I'll be talking about.
Let me ask you this. If you were assigning this as homework, what would you be wanting your students to be taking out of it?
Family dynamics, because when you're doing therapy, you've always got to look at family dynamics, personality qualities, that how they cluster and what they mean. And then, of course, with therapists, how the heck do you work with this? I think mm-hmm. it's a really, really good teaching opportunity for that.
Her whole public identity was really built around image. We saw that very clearly in this. It was someone who grew up with this as her sidekick from a very young age. And seemingly she got her validation from it through the lens of that camera, whether looking at herself and feeling good about herself or the comments she would get from other people. It was a TikTok persona, the way that she presented herself, the control. When you got somebody that has that level of self-obsession, and there's a lot of, you know, you look at people today, you look at young people today, you'd be hard pressed to find people who don't have a social media profile with probably what we would have classified as maybe 20 years ago, maybe an unhealthy level of self-interest, mm-hmm. the sheer amount of images that people take of themselves, mm-hmm. Posing in different ways, shapes, or forms. But there's people that take that and they still go even further, mm-hmm. to an even more extreme level. When you're looking at Mackenzie Schirillo, when you're looking at that level of self-obsession that she seemed to present, what is it tell you about her actual self-esteem, the person behind the mask on TikTok?
You know, there's a lot of good evidence that narcissism is increasing since social media, the use smartphones, the use of so much technology by kids. And we're seeing more and more narcissistic traits. Does that mean that they've got a full narcissistic personality disorder? It doesn't mean that. But it means that their identity is being filtered through what do people think of me? How do they view me? And so it disrupts the normal development of a sense of self. And that's definitely what I saw going on with her, is there's nothing under there. There's really nothing under there. And and does she have career aspirations? Does she have values? Does she have a sense of integrity? Or is it all just about look at me, look at me, look at me? And that's what jumped out for me.
Is that, are we missing something here in society? I feel like we the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction of where it once was, where we came from a world, and maybe truly this is where we still are, but there's a big mask over it, of a lot of insecurity, a lot of all of that, of negative self-talk, of doubt, of all, and people have that, and there's a healthy level to have of that. I mean, you need that positive to have negative and negative to have positive. But it feels like we went from this land of very low self-esteem to a land of insanely high self-esteem that's unfounded. And I don't even know if self-esteem is the right word. It feels more like delusion than it does actual self-esteem, this self-confidence. And as a parent, when you're looking at this and you're seeing this in children, I want to say, it may be somewhat easy for some parents to look at this and to go, look, well, I'm glad my kid is confident. I'm glad they're confident in their appearance and in how they're presenting themselves, because that's not at all how I was when I was a kid. That must be a good thing. This must be a great thing, right? Not so much, right. because this is not that what they're thinking of, because these people are coming up in a completely different world than we came up in. So it's not apples to apples or apples to oranges. It's more like apples to Chevys or something. It's not the same damn thing. Can you speak to that at all, of how different this is, how this is not self-confidence? This is something else entirely.
Yeah, it is the narcissistic sense of I'm special, look at me. And it's not coming from that place of vulnerability or, as you say, low self-esteem. I think we still see a lot of kids with low self-esteem, the ones that are not stars, the ones that aren't getting followers, the ones that aren't getting likes. And that can magnify their sense of inferiority, because they're comparing themselves to the McKinseys, you know, who act like celebrities and royalty, and they get all these followers. So I think we've got two paths, and both of them are problematic, and it's being fed by all this.
I mean, it was an interesting doc, some of the friends that were on there, they were talking, one of the friends who was backing her up quite a bit throughout it, talking about, she wanted to be a model like me. It's like, you're not a model. Like, you have a TikTok account. Right. Like, you're not a model in the sense. But maybe that's all being redefined as well. I don't know. But it's interesting, this almost like pseudo-celebrity persona that some of these young people think that they have. I mean, it's like high school on steroids, because the attention is coming from not just within high school, it's coming from other places as well, online, predators who like to look at children. You know, but a lot of these young girls think, oh, you know, the other women are looking at me, you know, jealous. No, they're just like you, bitch. But it's interesting. This it's such a delusional thought process, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to. It feels like the kids who are on this that were her friends, and they're young adults now too, everybody is operating from a place of delusion that does not really have a basis in reality for the roles and the lanes to which they are in real life.
Very much. And is the ultimate career aspiration to get on OnlyFans and make big money. And there are, unfortunately, a lot of kids who don't you know, when I always try to talk with teenagers about values, you know, get clear on, you know, developing yourself and what's important in life and what direction do you want to go. And I think for a lot of these kids like Mackenzie, they don't even understand the word values. It's getting stuff. It's getting money and getting attention above all. And that's kind of scary for where we're going to be in 20 years in society.
No, it really is. There's Speaking of the way that she was being interpreted by some of her friends, there's an assumption that narcissistic, controlling people, they're operating from a place of confidence. And I think some of her friends thought that. They think they still do think that. Mm-hmm. In your experience of treating people, someone who's acting like Mackenzie, this is the opposite of confidence. I got the same thing you did. This is a shell of a human being. There's nothing underneath the hood.
Yeah. There's nothing there. And we can actually move into, there's an interesting area that I was kind of surprised when I started taking notes because it really jumped out at me. The personality, now we can't diagnose a personality disorder in someone that we have not formally evaluated and gone through the checklist and all that, but we can comment on observable traits.
Yeah.
And there were certainly a lot of observable traits here that jumped out and were consistent. And personality is considered our stable pattern of perceiving, feeling, relating, and thinking and behaving across time. So when you look at a pattern, and we then define a personality disorder as when this is really not working for you, it's causing problems for you or for other people, and when it's significant and beyond what most of us see. So we've got three categories of personality disorders, A, B, and C in our diagnostic manual. A are people who are odd or eccentric. And I think we can put Brian Koberger in that category. Mm-hmm. The cluster B is dramatic or erratic. And these are the folks that cause big trouble. And I think we can say that we sure saw a lot of cluster B traits with Mackenzie. And then cluster C, people often don't know anything about this because they're not out causing trouble, but people who are incredibly anxious or fearful, that's cluster C. But as I went through the four personality disorders identified in cluster B, there were just certain things that jumped out at me. And these were the notes I took. So I just want to go over them. The first one that jumped out was borderline.
Yep.
And that's the intense fear of abandonment, the emotional dysregulation. They can go from being in this terrific mood to being rageful. And they're really difficult in romantic relationships. That's when a lot of this comes out. They're very impulsive. And whenever their attachment is threatened, when they feel like I'm not getting the attachment I want from my partner, I'm not getting the attention I want, I'm not coming first, they can get rageful. And that can get very scary and dangerous. And I think that ties in. Now, the other one in cluster B, the narcissistic features, the entitlement, the lack of empathy, the belief that their needs and emotions come first, and they don't have empathy for other people. The next one, a big one, the antisocial features. And this is akin to people who have psychopathic personality. The willingness to engage in dangerous, harmful behavior without sufficient regard for the rights and safety of others. Okay, that fits. We can certainly see that. And the last one is almost never talked about. It's poorly understood, but I think it's really, really relevant and important, is the histrionic personality. And this is the person who's attention-seeking, who wants to be the center of the room, the light of the party, the one everybody's looking at. And they tend to be very loud, emotionally shallow, and really manipulate using their sexuality. So when we look at the four different personality disorders, and as I say, it doesn't mean that she would have fit full criteria for any one of them. We can't know. But she sure had features. She had traits of each one of those. And I think that's really significant clinically. And that's something that I would hope new therapists can kind of hone in on and look at, whoa, we've really got, it's not just one category. We've got traits from all four of these categories.
Yeah, it's like she went to the Cluster B buffet and just filled up her plate with a little bit of everything. You know?
That's a good way to put it.
Like, yeah. I'll have a little more of this, a little more of that. Like, oh, goodness, you got a lot going on here in the borderline section. My God. But yeah, I mean, they, you're right. There was so much in all of this. When I was, and I'm looking at this and I'm going, okay, I mean, I was thinking the same sort of things. We look at her age, though, too. I want to bring that into this because at the time, we're the documented part of this case that we're looking at, she's 16, she's 17. Yeah. I mean, I think some of the videos probably even go back a little bit before that. She's, you know, 15 to roughly 17 years old through most of the documented portion of the crash and the scene we're talking about. Obviously, it is true, you know, teenage girls, boys, everybody, you know, people go through their stages, their phases and all that. And naturally, people can be fairly narcissistic at those younger ages. She, you know, she takes the cake. She goes well beyond the normal level. But I also know, you know, it's not something that is very common or encouraged, or I don't know if you even can, diagnosing someone under 18 with borderline personality or insert disorder here. Isn't that usually a little bit older in life?
You nailed it. That's a perfect point. Yeah. We do not diagnose a personality disorder before age 18 just because of that. Personality is developing still. You will have a different brain at 25 than you have at 16, let's say. But you can certainly see emerging traits. And often in elementary school, you start seeing these traits. And when we pay attention to it is when it's out of the norm, when it's much more so than what you see with most kids. I mean, all high school love affairs can be intense and dramatic, and people can, you know, get very fall in mad love at 13, you know.
Yeah.
And so, of course, we do not tag somebody as borderline personality at 12 or 13 or even 15, but you can certainly say, whoa, we're seeing some emerging traits here and we need to try to address this in therapy if we possibly can. Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, because there's a biological component to a lot of this stuff too that's not always been recognized and understood until recently. Somebody asked a really good question in the chat. Can you be diagnosed with more than one personality disorder? Technically you can. But very often, that's why we go with the cluster A, B, or C, because there's a lot of overlap in the disorders. And sometimes people don't meet the full criteria for just one, but they've got traits from each one. And so that's, you know, if you were writing a report, you would say cluster B traits. And maybe they do meet the full criteria. And you can meet the criteria for more than one. But a lot of times when we're not sure, or if it's a young person under 18, we may just say we see these traits emerging.
How does someone who clearly, very likely, obviously we can't diagnose, that likely has a, you know, like I said, the buffet of cluster B going on here. How, especially in a younger developing brain, how does marijuana use, psilocybin use, things of that nature, mushrooms, in case you're not familiar, you know, how does that affect that type of personality? Obviously, Dad is big on weed. He was very clear about that. I use it myself, but I'm a grown ass adult. I have a young daughter. I do not encourage it. I would not allow it for a young person.
And you're not driving down the freeway. Yeah.
And I'm not driving down the freeway making TikToks of the smoke coming. I'm in my bathroom at night before I go to bed, chilling out a little bit. So there's that. Dad doesn't seem to equate that there's a difference between himself and his 17-year-old daughter in terms of use and the effects. Okay. There is. There's a massive difference. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that a little bit for everybody who's like, well, at least she's not drinking. I mean, at least she's, you know, she's alive right now, I guess, is the good thing that's going on, even though that may not be everyone's opinion. Let's talk about the effects there.
Well, any kind of substance in a kid that's already angry and impulsive is going to increase their impulsivity. You know, any substance doesn't matter what it is. If it's a mood altering substance, alcohol, it's not good for them, and you're going to see more erratic behavior. It shuts down the prefrontal cortex. They're not thinking clearly. They're just coming from their emotional brain, which is where you get tantrums and that kind of behavior, because they're not able to rein themselves in. But I think we don't fully understand the complex changes that happen in a developing brain from cannabis. We are seeing now, there's new research that's very good, very well done, that some younger people, if they have a genetic predisposition to psychosis, something like schizophrenia, that the cannabis can set it off. And that's very scary, because we don't know if they come back from that psychosis, and some of them don't. So that's newer research. Yes, we've traditionally looked at cannabis as something probably less harmful to the brain than alcohol is. But in a young person, the effects can be magnified, and it's not completely understood yet.
Yeah. And when you got everybody going there encouraging, hey, let's do a lot of reckless things while you're a young, reckless person, that doesn't really help anything. As cool dad as he wants to be, and now he has all the time in the world that he's unemployed to smoke it up at home and tell himself he's done nothing wrong while his daughter's in prison.
Exactly.
So, worked out well, didn't it, Dad? Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue the conversation. The links are in the description. Psychology of the relationship itself. That's what I want to get into as we're talking about Mackenzie Schirilla, the subject of the crash on July 2nd, 2022. Less than a month before the crash, Dominic Russo texted Mackenzie that he didn't think they should be together anymore. He was 20. She was 17. They'd been together for about 4 years, high school relationship, in a relationship family members described as explosive, full of breakups and threats. 29 days later, Dominic was dead in the passenger seat of her car. I want to talk about this a little bit. I know we touched on it a little in our first chapter, but let's dive deeper now into some of her interpersonal relationships, especially the romantic relationship that she had with Dominic, and what it means when this type of personality is confronted with something like that, with a breakup, with somebody saying, I'm not going along with this anymore. This isn't for me. This is because everybody likes to put themselves in the other person's shoes without considering the psychology of the person. It's like, well, if that was me, here's how I would handle it. Do you have a cluster B personality disorder? Like, if you don't, then doesn't really matter what you think or feel. Because this person's prism, the way they're seeing and interpreting this information, the cause and effect, is a very different process than a healthy brain. So when we're coming to this, when you have this confrontation, and it seemed like it was pretty light. It seems like Dominic was trying to handle it with as kid gloves of hands as he could, and he seemed to know why. She was explosive of, you know, this isn't working out, when she gets that information. Why is that so different to somebody with cluster B than somebody who isn't? Why does it feel so catastrophic, and what can the consequences be when they're met with it?
Yeah, it's a great, great area to explore. I have the sense from so much that we saw and the people that described them that yes, the relationship was very volatile, but it was also very enmeshed. They spent a lot of time together. She was living with him at 17. It's like,
that's another why mom and dad said this is okay.
That's okay. Yeah. But they tend to enmesh with their partner in a way that rejection feels like a loss of themselves, because there isn't much of a self there. And so they're incredibly dependent on their partner. And when the partner starts distancing, they start throwing tantrums and they start getting more controlling, which is really the last thing you want to do if you want to attract someone back to you, is become abusive and controlling and threatening. But you see a lot of tantrums. And I think that we saw that going on too. People will do the suicide threats. attempt to, I can't tell you how many times I've seen people having a big fight in the car over something like this. And one of them tries to jump out of the car on the freeway. I mean, there's no real thinking going on because there's just not enough of a person inside there. And so they're very, very enmeshed and dependent on this partner.
I mean, it sometimes feels like scared animal. Mm-hmm. From the perspective of a healthier brain when you're with a partner like that, where when they're confronted with that, you know, like sometimes if you have like your dog in your lap or whatever animal, cat, doorbell rings, that animal's going to like flail and get from point A to point B, however they have to. They don't give a shit who they're going to scratch, what they're going to knock over, what could fall on top of them. Like it's just react. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Is that a fairly accurate way of describing how a cluster B type thinker works, especially in this type of a situation when confronted with that sort of information? It's sheer reaction. Mm-hmm. And I guess why is there this incapability of taking a breath, evaluate mm-hmm. the situation before reacting however they may end up reacting? Let's start there.
Yeah, it's a really good analogy. And that just shows that, you know, the part of the brain that thinks, that can be grounded in reality, that can come up with coping skills, that's all the prefrontal cortex, you know, mm-hmm. that's the thinking brain. And it just shows how much a person like this is controlled by their emotional brain. And the development of that thinking brain, it's just not there. It's just not happening. And you'll see this extreme reaction. There was a case here in Portland this week, again, another familicide, where this is when it's usually a woman is trying to leave a relationship with a cluster B man, and it ends up with the murder of the family, including the kids. And so, you know, where's the thought process going on here? Someone that you supposedly love wants to leave you, and so you kill them and you kill your children. I mean, that's, you know, very hard for people to wrap their head around. I've been thinking of writing a book on that topic and trying to explain how that happens, just because I monitor those cases. They're in the news all the time.
They are. Yeah.
You know, and people will always say, oh, well, we thought he was a nice guy. We thought they had a loving relationship. And it's like, no, there was a problem, a big problem going on.
Development of the brain. Obviously, you know, there's natural things that happen. There's conditional things that happen when you live in a household and your parents are telling you most of your life that, everyone else is wrong. When a problem arises, it's somebody else's fault. It's this, it's that. It can't be you. It's, oh my gosh, they're the victim. You're the victim. Everybody's being victimized by the outside world. Mm-hmm. That doesn't do a whole lot to help develop that brain now, does it?
No. I call the formula for this kind of thing, it's caused by parental overindulgence. That's what creates it. You know, again, one thing I often talk about is we always want to blame aberrant human development on abuse in childhood. And abuse in childhood is a really big thing to understand and to address and to try to stop and to see kids are raised with love and affirmation and all of that. But it's not the cause of every kind of bad human behavior. There are genetics involved, and combine that with an upbringing where you're just indulged all the time, as you described so well, and you can get these kind of problems.
You know, the word abuse, people think of it in terms of hitting your kids. You know, there is very overt abuse, you know, mm-hmm. saying horrible things to your, there's all sorts of ways, sexually, that sort of, there's also, but we don't often think of overindulgence as abuse. Mm-hmm. It really is mm-hmm. at the end. If you're going to such an extreme, I mean, it's like taking your kid to the Sunday bar at the frozen yogurt place once a week, once a month, whatever. That's not abuse. That's a treat. That can be a bonding experience. It can be a rewarding experience, maybe if it's for some reason. Yeah. If you literally build the Sunday bar in their room mm-hmm. and then Toppings galore anytime you want. You want some more froyo? It's just pour it. Let's let it run in your room. It doesn't matter. We'll just keep refilling the tanks. Let it fill the house. If that's what's going on from an emotional standpoint, in terms of guardrails, that's abuse. I mean, if you were doing that with your child with frozen yogurt and toppings, it would also be abuse. That seems to be, from my opinion, from the standpoint of what we've seen here with these yahoos that raised this child, it's a frozen yogurt bar on, you know, endless stream.
Yeah. Eat all the ice cream you want, kid. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yeah. Inadequate parenting is probably how we'd put it in a report, but I like the way you frame that. I'm going to steal that analogy. I think that's very apt.
It's true. It can, you know, rewards, positive, that's good. But when that's all you are and there's no guardrails, my God. Another thing about this that I think a lot of people are questioning is, you know, we're talking about kind of the knee-jerk reaction of a lot of cluster B type people where we made the animal analogy, oh, freak out, bad news. But some of what they're talking about here in the documentary, in the case, is that there was calculation that seemed to have gone on to a certain extent here, allegedly. That can be an interesting part to this, too. It's not always just bad news, let me freak out. There's allegations that she had been driving the route beforehand, checking it out a little bit. Was she practicing? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody really does. She threatened to crash a car, allegedly, and there's arguments over whether she said it or that's in the doc, too. But there does seem to be some signs of possible premeditation here. I'm not saying that they're super legit, but there are certain things that sometimes happen that are premeditated. That's an interesting aspect to this, is it?
It's really hard to know with this case. And I was trying to look for evidence of that. The thing that just I kept going back to is she was definitely manipulative and could become a bully. And I think that kind of thing is premeditated because it had worked for her in life. You know, probably a lot of her parents indulging her was to keep her from getting angry, to keep her from getting upset. So giving in to her. But when it came to the car crash, I just really couldn't get a sense of what would go on, because that's a hell of a way to die. If you were planning, you know, to suicide that way, because it would have been a suicide as well. Boy, that's, you know, that's no way to do it. So I tend to go back to my guess, which is just a guess, that this event with, you know, pressing the accelerator all the way to the floor and going 100 miles an hour into a brick building, something set her off, something that was said, and she got really angry and just wasn't thinking in the moment. And so it may be something that she had thought about before. I mean, obviously, if there had been the discussion of who's trying to crash the car, you know, but really I can't count how many times these kind of situations happen. Argument in the car, sometimes even grown adults will try to jump out of the car while it's moving. It's like, here's this big dramatic thing. But they'll also, if there's a gun handy, they'll pick up a gun, you know, and start shooting and maybe shoot themselves after. I mean, you just get this tantrum kind of behavior.
Yeah. Is there a world here where she floored it at 100%, and we know she did, into the side of that building, where she didn't understand the cause and effect of her actions? And if so, I mean, that if you don't have any reps in cause and effect, and no one's taught you that, and everyone's enabled you your whole life, and there are no consequences to your actions. We saw that in the doc of her telling off teachers and being a horrible student, all that shit. And dad's like, I looked her in the eye and she said, did you do it? She said, no. And I picked her up and we got out of there. Yeah. You're a fucking moron. And you're a sad excuse for a dad and a human being.
Yeah.
When that's how you are raising a child, and then this situation presents itself. I don't know. Maybe he said something triggered. Maybe he said, I want to break up, whatever. And she doesn't understand cause and effect because it's never been there. Is there a world here where she there's just, I'm going to floor this and go towards this building and of course, we'll all be fine at the end of the day.
Very much. Yeah. And when that amygdala gets set off and you've got this rage reaction going, I think you, for some people, they completely lose the ability to think logically about cause and effect. And there's also the weird thing with teenagers, which you see a lot with the different kinds of suicide things that they do, they don't realize that death is forever, when they're not thinking logically. And sometimes it's this sense of, well, I'm going to do this and then everybody's going to feel bad. And I'm going to be watching and enjoying the fact that everybody feels bad after the suicide. And it's like, it doesn't work that way.
It's almost like they're thinking in video game. Like you're going to, go watch the cutscene and then it'll be right back to me. Yeah. No, that's not how life works. When it comes down to something like that, ultimately the person, who is ultimately responsible is a person who had their foot on that gas pedal going at 100 miles an hour. But I would also say, in my opinion, dad, mom, you're also just as responsible for that foot being on that gas pedal. Mm-hmm. At 100%, because you failed. You failed her so miserably that this is the way she operates. Mm-hmm. And she's able to drive a car. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, what could possibly go wrong? A lot. Mm-hmm. A lot can go wrong in a situation like that. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Let's go into another chapter of this story. Mackenzie Shirilla says she has no memory of the crash, said it at the hospital, said it at trial, said it now from prison in Netflix's The Crash. The families don't believe her. Dominic's father says he just wants the truth so he can grieve. Two young men are dead and everyone touched by this case is carrying something that they can't put down. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us to help break all of this down. I want to talk about that, about the idea that Mackenzie has no memory of what happened and the version of reality, the version of the truth, and I put that in air quotes, that everybody wants. Let's start with, is it a very real possibility that she does not remember what happened in those final moments?
Sure. It's possible. People who have gone through a traumatic event, particularly when they've been severely injured, can have a sense of, I don't remember exactly what happened. Usually they have fragments, bits and pieces. It may be nonlinear, but they have, flashes of something. But the other thing that popped into my head was head injury. Definitely, if she had a concussion, people lose memory after that often and don't remember what led up to it. So that was my guess. I don't think we got enough about all her medical, data, what was all happening to her after that. But it certainly could have been something that after the impact, that the brain injury, just her brain wasn't working at that point.
Is it reasonable to think that she was trying to murder them, based on everything that we know, based on her track record of impulsive, volatile reactions to any sort of information that comes her way that she doesn't like, and then this happening, is it reasonable to think that she was attempting a murder here, or is it really just something else?
I would not have voted for murder. I just think in a person like this, it's rage-induced, tantrum, impulsive, and there's not a sense of sitting back even for 5 minutes and saying, gee, I think I'm going to kill my boyfriend tonight. and our friend in the back who has done nothing to me. I don't think that, I mean, for me, that would not fit murder. It's horrible. It's abhorrent.
Yeah.
But I would not have voted for murder.
It's more of an inability to empathize with anything outside of oneself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good way to put it. To understand that I've got to be careful with how I express my anger here because I have concern that nobody else is damaged or injured, no matter how angry I am. You know, mm-hmm. that would be the healthy, normal way to respond. Sometimes people are so upset, they'll say, I don't feel safe to drive my car, you know, because sure. they realize I'm too upset right now. Good. Don't get in the car when you're agitated. Yeah.
Yeah. If you ever have that feeling, go with it. Don't get in the car.
Don't get in the car.
If you have the red flag, you're a healthier person than this. So please do that. Let's talk for a minute. Something else that we brought up in the intro there. One of the parents, and my heart breaks for them because number one, I cannot imagine what it would be like going through that. I actually had to turn this thing off about 15 minutes in because I was just getting too depressed. I was like, being a father of a 13-year-old, you know, I'm getting into the age of teenagerness and narcissism and all that shit. And, you know, it can be overwhelming sometimes as a parent. And it was just like, I was watching it on Sunday morning. I'm like, I don't want to ruin the rest of my day. Cause it just, it was too much. But watching it and seeing the finishing it and I watched it another time too, and seeing the heartbreak of these parents, I can't contemplate what the hell that must feel like to lose your child to the hand of some mutant like this. But they also, one of the things that I thought was interesting that was said, and I'm not criticizing this. My only thought in bringing this up is this should be reframed to try and get on a path of healing. That's it. It's my opinion. It was said, you know, if she would just basically tell the truth, if she would tell us what she remembers. She already told you she doesn't remember anything. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you're going to get to anything that she remembers. Even if she did, that's not going to change anything. Right. I mean, hearing her say the words, I killed them on purpose, which is never going to happen. It's not going to bring you closure. Nor is it necessarily reality either. It will fit in into the square peg hole you have over here of how this should make sense to you. But unfortunately, this doesn't make sense. This was pointless. Yeah. There was no reason for this. This totally didn't need to happen. And that means that they died in vain, and they did. It was completely pointless. Yeah. But that's a very hard thing to understand and accept. I can't imagine wrapping my mind around that as a parent. Yeah. But that statement of they need closure, he needs closure, he needs her to say that she essentially did this on purpose.
Right.
What would you say to that, to someone who's feeling that way?
It's a really tough one because I think it's a human tendency to want a comprehensive narrative that makes sense.
Yeah. You know,
a beginning to the story, a middle to the story, an end of the story. We want it to be logical, fit those puzzle pieces together. But you're right. In this case, it's not going to make sense ever. There's not going to be a good reason, a sensible, logical reason that this happened. And it's going to be a journey for them, I think. Anger is one of the phases of grief. And of course, they're going to be incredibly angry at her, and understandable. We all would. Mm-hmm. And that may take a decade. It may take 20 years. It may never go away for them because everybody's got their own path with how they process through grief. But that would probably be the message I would be sharing gently to them, is that this is going to be something that you probably will never have all the pieces to. And it's, as you said, it's something that's never, never going to make sense. And it's going to be something you grieve forever. There's never really very much, you know, when we look at closure, maybe we can get to a sense of acceptance about what happened, and that may feel, you know, better than I've just got to find out the answer here with all the questions I have. But acceptance is the final phase of grief, where we just can sit with something so painful and so terrible and so senseless happened, but it is what it is, and come to a place where we can just live with acceptance of that.
Since the doc has aired, TMZ, a lot of different places have been digging up phone calls between Mackenzie and her mother and other people, and the litany of jailhouse violations, a lot of them sexual, and the phone calls, if you listen to them, it's just a lot of it's a narcissist talking to her flying monkey. Monkey happens to be mom. Mm-hmm. In a lot of this, where it's you're persecuted, and that's for real prisoners. Like she's not a real prisoner. Like she doesn't deserve to be there for 15 years for taking the lives of two people through her neurotic ways of thinking. What do you make of all of the afterthought, all the other stuff we're finding out, that she's still the same narcissistic monster that she was before the accident, after? I'm not shocked at all by any of this. A lot of people seem to be, but I think me and you know, and a lot of other people who've dealt with this sort of personality before, of course, it's par for the course. But do people have this idea that big thing happens, that's going to be the changing point? It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not for these people.
No, it's not. Especially for someone with this combination of traits. If they learn from experience, you know, they would have learned a long time ago. And this embracement of a victim narrative that the parents validate, that this, how unfair and unjust she's being treated. Yeah, it just reinforces it. And it has a very poor prognosis for her ability to ever gain any insight or learn or grow. There was another thing that I found interesting, that her parents were allowing her to live with Dom at such a young age.
Let's talk about that.
Well, and one of the interviews with Dad that I saw, you know, post-documentary, where he's sort of trying to repair the damage, and it, every time he talks, he just makes it worse.
Pouring gas.
Yeah.
And he ashes his blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But they had spoken in the documentary about, oh, Dom had so much money and it was really great because he spent so much on Mackenzie, and Mackenzie likes nice things and all this, right? Dom was dealing drugs, and the dad just said that they knew he was dealing drugs, and he had a house full of guns and half of them were loaded. Okay. And you let your 17-year-old, I mean, I just can't wrap my head around that.
What, obviously we can't diagnose here, but what kind of self-delusion is going on there with Dad? Is he just that perpetually high that he's just, whoa, everything's cool, man? That's how he seemed to kind of want to come across, it feels like, on the dock, in my opinion. But what kind of delusion is going on in one's mind that one thinks, oh, this seems like a lovely setting for my minor daughter?
I think the perpetually high is probably about as good as we can get. But she got these traits from somewhere. And I mentioned that there are biological factors that can go along. There are genetic factors. And so she may be a lot like Dad. And maybe Dad has some of these qualities himself. So.
If only she was chill, you know, like Dad. Like, I mean, and maybe that works for Dad, of being chill. But it works for Dad as himself, just not as a dad, as a father figure. It works if you're an 18-year-old boy living in a one-bedroom apartment by themselves, you know, and chilling out with your buddies. That's about the only setting that works, and it still seems like he still probably kind of operates from that way of thinking, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking earlier about the crash itself. A lot of people are surprised that the way that she's acting from behind bars, and the things that she's saying and the things that she's doing. And for some people, a hitting rock bottom moment, like killing your boyfriend and your friend and your vehicle and being incarcerated for possibly the rest of your life, might be the moment that it strikes you that, maybe I need to change my ways. This hasn't, clearly. If this hasn't, is there really anything that would ever fix? And that's in a very gray word, but is there anything would ever correct or change the path of Mackenzie if this hasn't?
Well, you know, I always like to hold hope, right? That's my job.
Yeah.
That's my job. Work with difficult cases and try to hold hope. If I had to write a report, I'd say prognosis guarded here. Doesn't look real good. And especially her behavior since she's been locked up isn't indicating that she's having insight and, you know, changing. And so prognosis is not good. Now, I will say with the cluster B personality disorders, if somebody is borderline and has, you know, let's say they don't have the antisocial traits, they don't have all the narcissism, it's just more classic borderline personality, you can gain a lot of progress in therapy, and there are specific kinds of therapy that help with that. But that's the one thing out of this, and a big piece of that is teaching emotional regulation so they can learn to control themselves better. And so if she were in prison and got a lot of therapy specifically for learning emotional regulation skills, she might get a little better with that. But I doubt that that's going to happen in prison for her. So odds are not good.
I had a list in another piece, and I have it in front of me, of just the things that she said. I'm summarizing here, paraphrasing. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with me. I don't need help. I don't need this. Right. You know, and then you got mom and dad further reinforcing that way of thinking. As long as mom and dad are in the picture, in their current mindset, is she hopeless? I mean, is the best thing for her to go no contact with her parents, essentially?
Yeah.
Because they're not going to help her turn in, like, she'll just be this monster. They'll eventually die, and she'll just be as dysfunctional as she's always been.
Yeah, because really they've colluded with her.
Yeah.
And in the documentary, they were colluding with her with this, oh, I think she passed out because of POTS. And, you know, if you've ever fainted, you go limp. You don't floor it. You don't floor it. Yeah. I've fainted one time in my life and I just went limp. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but they collude and they keep up the story, this narrative that she's a victim and this is also unfair, and it keeps her from developing and from learning anything.
How do you get through to the parents? Because that, I mean, at the end of the day here, like, I don't think Mackenzie is capable of changing on her own. I think she would need the right people, the right reinforcement, the right system, the right, as Robin would say, loving critic. These are not loving critics. These are enablers. These are flying monkeys that are her parents. Mm-hmm. If she had the right system, maybe. Because there is an element to her that I do have some sympathy for and some empathy for, of being the product of where she came from. Ultimately, she's an adult. She made her own choices. But I do have some empathy there of, like, God, if that could change, if that could shift, if mom and dad could get their shit together and see reality on reality's terms, maybe. But then she'd also have to accept it, too. But it's got to start somewhere. And if the only people she's communicating with and trusts outside of prison people were able to come to her from a different direction, from a different place, and change the conversation, I hate that term, up, if you will, but change the direction and the lane that they're going in, maybe something could happen. But how do you change parents who are thinking this way?
Yeah, if they haven't gotten any insight right now, at this point, again, prognosis very poor, and they would probably get very angry at anyone. And they're probably angry at all of us right now.
I'm sure they are.
Everybody,
I'm sure they're
on the
swearing.
Internet, they're mad, because how dare anyone question their parenting? How dare anyone question their narrative, their story about their poor child? And I don't think there's probably any way to get through with it. I would be up for having a try, but it would be slow going, and they would probably be people that would, you know, have one session with a counselor and then storm out, because how dare you, you know, even question us.
Why is that with people like that? Because it's like, clearly the path they're working is not going good. It's just straight downhill everywhere you look. And you have all these people, and I'm not coming to this from a, like, I'm not trying to insult them. I'm not trying to say they're idiots, even though they are, but I'm trying to go, here's a path to try and figure out a way to be healthier, to be happier for yourself, for your daughter. And why is that? That people just continue to dig in on the path that is nothing but chaos when all of the evidence points otherwise.
If you got to know each of them and their histories, I think it would make sense.
Yeah.
And they may have some of these personality qualities as well that, you know, don't manifest in the same way, but some of this not taking responsibility, not learning from experience, you know, being always in the position of victim. Our child can do no wrong because it meets their emotional needs to perceive it that way, even if it's not true. And so there are reasons, but it's hard to speculate exactly what those reasons are. Could be rooted in their own histories, the way they were brought up, maybe.
Tell me what you thought. I mean, when I listened to the phone calls between Mackenzie and her mother, or even the parents talking on that documentary, it felt like we were watching two high school children. The parents themselves, very emotionally immature on their thought processes.
Mm-hmm. Very emotionally immature and lacking insight and not having boundaries. And as you say, dad wants to be cool. Mom wants to collude with her and be her best friend. And so there's a lack of insight and maturity there, definitely.
I like to end on these ones because I believe we know a lot of these, they have tablets in jail and narcissists like to watch information about themselves. So when Mackenzie eventually stumbles upon this one and, you know, she's sitting there, you know, fuming through it. We get to this point from, you know, obviously you're always coming from a place of goodness and positivity and well, good intentions. What would you say to her?
I would advise her to start writing in prison. A lot of people gain insight and awareness by writing and talk about, you know, address some specific topics about who is she and what does she want the rest of her life to look like and what kind of growth and change can create. I always say that we're all writing a book. Our lives are a book and we're all authors of that book. And at the end of life, when we're taking our final breath, what kind of story do we want to look back and read about? What do we want that book to look like? And so I often try to get folks to engage in a writing process where they really start reflecting on their values, their choices, and what is the book of their life that they're writing. That would be my advice.
Yeah, and that's a good way of looking at it. And the thing is, you know, without being too philosophical, she's so young. She still has her whole book to write.
Yes.
And it can be a redemption story. It doesn't have to be the victim mentality that mom and dad like to feed her. Yeah. She has her own story to write and she can write it, or she can just go to her death with whatever mom and dad want to tell her she is. But that's up to her. And she can turn this around. She could become an advocate. She could help younger people from falling into this path that she was put into biologically and physically with her parents and her upbringing, and helping other people see a better path and correct before it gets so out of control. But that takes some self-realization and reflection. And maybe she's capable, maybe she's not. She's the only one that can really answer that question. But there's a challenge to do it.
Yeah. Create a better story, and not just a story where you're the victim. That would be my feedback. Create a story where you are taking control, not complaining about what other people are doing.
I like that. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, is available wherever you get books. And her other book, The Mind of Mass Killers, also available wherever you get books. And if you call right now, we're going to give you a second Ginsu knife. Absolutely. Okay, that's not part of it. But they're available wherever you get books. Go and check it out. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan and Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.